Learning a language, as we've just demonstrated, is a formidable challenge, at least if you're not a child dropped into the process involuntarily. And learning some languages can be harder than learning others. A French speaker might find learning Spanish easier than, say, Cantonese. But one could argue that that's really because French and Spanish are so similar. Well, not so, says linguist John McWhorter, author of a witty and readable history of language called The Power of Babel. John McWhorter says some languages are, by any standard, more complicated, more difficult than others. And most languages, he says, are more complicated than they really have to be.
Languages, in general, are overgrown beyond what we exactly need for communication. So, for example, if we speak English, we would assume that one would need to have a word the as opposed to the word a to distinguish the man we were talking about from a man that I bring up right now. But actually, a great many languages in the world don't have any words like that at all, and that's just left to context. And where the rub is that there is no particular point at which languages balance. It's really a rather random process. And so what it means is that all languages are complex to a degree, but there are some languages which, by any objective metric, are more complex systems than others.
Certainly, for native English speakers, the notion of a language with lots of declensions and genders, that's a complicated language.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for us, because we're relatively low on that sort of thing. But what's interesting is that the genders and declensions that we might encounter in a Latin or a Russian are child's play compared to some of the sorts of things that you see in some Native American languages or some African or Australian languages. And then there are languages where, for example, you have to add a little bit of stuff onto your verb to indicate whether you saw something, heard something, or you've heard it around, or you get the feeling. And if you don't use that little element, then you're not really speaking the language. So you have to learn those, etc.
You write about one African language that, if it doesn't take the prize for being the most complicated language we've heard about, it's certainly up there in the finals.
Oh, yeah, there's Fula. Fula is spoken in various places in West Africa. Its homeland is on the upper West African coast. And Fula, as spoken as a first language by people who are of that culture, is just a frightfully complex language. Not only does it have gender, but it's got as many as 16 of these genders, and there are all sorts of alternations of consonants depending on what endings you use that are not exactly intuitive. Then the verbs do the same thing, and you go through a grammar of Fula, and you sincerely wonder how anybody could speak this language for longer than 5 minutes without their head exploding, and yet obviously people do it.
We should explain that the proof that gender in grammar is not the same as gender in sex is that you can have 16 genders in a language. You don't
yes,
have
exactly.
a name for
so
male, female, neuter. There are no
shapes of things and little things, big things. And then, of course, there might be some things that are identifiably biologically male or female. But yeah, gender is a linguist term for what we might call just classes of nouns.
But linguists write, and you write, about a process that takes place as Fula speakers, say, might be joined by immigrants who would come into their midst.
That's right. And what happens is that if a language is used in a place more by people as a second language than as a first language, then it starts to simplify. And so there are varieties of Fula which, in a way, make a lot more sense to people who speak English because they're shorn of a great deal of these alternations with noun classes and similar processes happening with the verbs. And there are a lot of languages around the world where, while they're quite complex, they are less so than they used to be because there was a great deal of second language learning. And if you ask me, and this is extremely controversial, but in current work, I'm attempting to show that that actually happened to English in Great Britain around the time of the Viking invasions, because English, as Germanic languages go, like German and Swedish and Icelandic, is rather simplified compared to the others.
So there is, to the extent that societies mingle and there's migration or conquest, for that matter, there's a natural progression from little intricate languages mm-hmm. toward bigger, more simple languages.
That seems to definitely be the case. If you find a culture in the rainforest, say only 300 people strong, almost always that language is almost counterintuitively complex. We have a natural sense, perhaps, that a relatively undeveloped culture would have a relatively simple language. Actually, not so at all. And it's the big bad Berlitz languages, so to speak, such as English or even Japanese, that tend to be relatively simple. And what that means is that as we go through the lives that we're leading at this point and we see globalization, chances are that a lot of the world's languages are going to become less complex.
Now, the fact that language is constantly changing is illustrated by a story you cite about speakers of Miami.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Would not
right.
be in Florida, but up around Indiana and Ohio near the
that's
Miami
right.
River.
Miami happened to be the name of a Native American language. And the fact is that languages are always in the process of turning upside down. That's somewhat obscured with the relatively few languages. Only about 200 languages in the world that are regularly written and regularly read, because the printed page has a way of holding the change back, because it gives us a model that we keep striving towards. But ordinary language change is such that there was data from this Miami language recorded in the 1600s, and this was shown to some of the last speakers of Miami in the late 20th century, and their immediate response was, oh, these are old constructions. This is kind of like the way my great-great-grandmother talked, or something like that. Or there's an even better example, which is that in 1930, there was a language in Australia that mm-hmm. was innocently recorded by some anthropologists. And then, 60 years later, some linguists checked up on the language. And in that time, the language's grammar had changed so much that it was virtually a different language.
Why do you think it is that language, unsimplified by migration or big population movements of some sort or another, mm-hmm. why does it get so much more complex than is necessary? What do you think drives us toward adding all kinds of, as you would say, little filigrees and doodads onto language?
Robert, that is a new frontier question, but I can venture an answer. I think that one of the things that's important to realize that it's not so much that speakers are driven to create these doodads and bells and whistles. It's that these things creep into the language. They drift in without anybody actually trying very hard for it to happen. So, for example, even in English, we talk about the and a. The started out as that. And it used to be that we didn't have a the. We just had that. And so you can say something like, you know, a certain someone saying, I did not sleep with that woman, the mm-hmm. idea being to point her out. Now, as time goes by, the that kind of weakens in its force. And so instead of meaning that woman right there, it just means, well, the woman who we brought up in conversation. Now, that wasn't something anybody was driven to do. It was just a matter of a gradual evolution of that that no one person could actually have been aware of. Multiply that by 250 different things happening in any grammar at any given time, and next thing you know, you've got fula. So it seems to be a matter of drift rather than drive, but it does seem to be the natural tendency of human language.